Hello, this is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with the Thursday, April 9th reading of Newsmax. Iran closes Strait of Hormuz again over Israeli attacks in Lebanon. Iran closed the Strait of Hormuz again Wednesday in response to Israeli attacks against the Hezbollah terrorist group in Lebanon, casting doubt over whether an already precarious ceasefire to end more than a month of war will hold. The United States and Iran both claimed victory after reaching the agreement, and world leaders expressed relief even as more drones and missiles hit Iran and Gulf Arab countries. Israel has intensified its attacks in Lebanon, hitting several commercial and residential areas in Beirut without warning. At least 112 people were killed and hundreds were wounded in one of the deadliest days in the latest Israel-Hezbollah war. The fresh violence threatened to scuttle what Vice President J.D. Vance called a fragile deal. Aggression towards Lebanon is aggression towards Iran, General Saeed Majid Mousavi, aerospace commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, wrote on X. He warned that Iranian forces were preparing a heavy response without revealing details. War Secretary Pete Hegseth said American and Israeli forces had achieved a capital V military victory, and that the Iranian military no longer posed a significant threat to U.S. forces or the region. The Iranian military said the country forced Israel and the U.S. to accept its proposed conditions and surrender. Much about the agreement was unclear as the sides presented vastly different visions of the terms. Iran said the deal would allow it to formalize its new practice of charging ships passing through the strait, a crucial transit lane for oil, but the details were not clear, nor was it known whether vehicles or vessels would feel safe using the channel, or whether ship traffic had resumed. It also was unclear whether any other country agreed to this condition. Pakistan, which helped to mediate the deal, and others, said fighting would pause in Lebanon, where Israel has launched a ground invasion against the Iran-backed Hezbollah terrorist group. Israel said it would not, and strikes hit Beirut on Wednesday. The fate of Iran's missile and nuclear programs, the elimination of which were major objectives for the U.S. and Israel, is going to war, also remained unclear. Trump said the U.S. would work with Iran to remove buried enriched uranium, though Iran did not confirm that. In the streets of Tehran, pro-government demonstrators screamed, "Death to America, death to Israel, death to compromisers," after the ceasefire announcement, and burned American and Israeli flags. The chants underscored the anger animating hardliners who have been preparing for what many assumed would be an apocalyptic battle with the United States. Trump warned Tuesday that a whole civilization will die tonight if a deal was not reached. Trump initially said Iran proposed a workable 10-point plan that could help end the war the U.S. and Israel launched on February 28th. But when a version of Farsi emerged that indicated Iran would be allowed to continue enriching uranium, which is key to building a nuclear weapon, Trump called it fraudulent without elaborating. Vance later said the deal was being misrepresented within Iran, though he did not offer details. Iran's demands for ending the war include a withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from the region, the lifting of sanctions, and the release of its frozen assets. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, personal envoy, arrived in Iran for talks on the way forward. Pakistan said talks to seek a permanent end to the war could begin in Islamabad as soon as Friday. Trump told the New York Post that in-person talks would happen very soon. Israel backed the U.S. ceasefire with Iran, but Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the deal does not cover fighting against Hezbollah. Trump told the PBS NewsHour that Lebanon was not included in the ceasefire deal because of Hezbollah. Israel Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Ayil Zamir said Israel will continue to utilize every operational opportunity to strike Hezbollah. The Israeli military said it struck more than 100 targets within 10 minutes Wednesday across Lebanon, the largest wave of strikes since March 1st. Lebanese President Joseph Aoun condemned the Israeli attacks as barbaric. Arab League Chief Ahmed Abul Ghit accused Israel of persistently seeking to sabotage the Iran ceasefire deal. Hezbollah has not confirmed if it will abide by the ceasefire, though the group has said it was open to giving mediators a chance to secure an agreement. An official, speaking on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to comment publicly, said the group would not stop firing at Israel unless Israel agreed to do the same. While Iran could not match the sophistication of U.S. and Israeli weaponry or their dominance in the air, its ability to control the Strait of Hormuz proved a tremendous strategic advantage. Iranian attacks and threats deterred many commercial ships from passing through the waterway, through which 20% of all traded oil and natural gas passes in peacetime. That roiled the world economy and raised the pressure on Trump both at home and abroad to find a way out of the standoff. The ceasefire may formalize a system of charging fees in the strait that Iran instituted and give it a new source of revenue. The plan allows for both Iran and Oman to charge ships, according to regional officials who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss negotiations they were directly involved in. The official said Iran would use the money it raised for reconstruction. That would upend decades of precedent treating the strait as an international waterway that was free to transit and will likely not be acceptable to the Gulf Arab states, which also need to rebuild after repeated Iranian attacks targeting their oil fields. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said passage through the strait would be allowed under Iranian military management, further clouding the picture of who would be allowed to transit the waterway. News of the ceasefire sent stock markets surging worldwide and oil prices plunged back toward $90 per barrel. U.S.-Israeli strikes have battered Iran and its leadership, but they have not entirely eliminated the threats posed by Tehran's nuclear program, its ballistic missiles, or its support for regional proxies like Hezbollah. The U.S. and Israel said addressing those threats was a key justification for going to war. Trump said Wednesday that the U.S. would work with Iran to dig up and remove enriched uranium that was buried under joint U.S.-Israeli strikes in June. He added that none of the material had been touched since. Any retrieval is expected to be an intensive undertaking. There was no confirmation from Iran. Hegseth told a Pentagon briefing Wednesday that the U.S. would do something like last June's joint strikes with Israel on Iranian nuclear sites if the country refuses to surrender its enriched uranium voluntarily. Tehran insisted for years that its nuclear program was peaceful, although it enriched uranium up to 60% purity, a short technical step from weapons-grade levels. Iran referred to its nuclear program differently in two versions of the ceasefire plan that it released. The version in Farsi included the phrase acceptance of enrichment for its nuclear program. That phrase was missing in English versions shared by Iranian diplomats with journalists. Shortly after the ceasefire announcement, Bahrain, Israel, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates all issued warnings about incoming missiles from Iran. That fire stopped for a time, then hostilities appeared to restart. An oil refinery on Iran's Lavan Island came under attack, according to Iranian state television. The state broadcaster reported that no one was hurt, but did not say who launched the attack. The island is home to one of the terminals that Iran uses to export oil and gas. A short time later, the United Arab Emirates air defenses fired an at an incoming Iranian missile barrage. Kuwait said Wednesday three power and water desalination plants were badly damaged after 28 Iranian drones were launched at the country. Saudi Arabia said it intercepted 9 drones. More than 1,900 people have been killed in Iran as of late March, but the government has not updated the war's toll for days. In Lebanon, where Israel is fighting Iran-backed Hezbollah militants, more than 1,500 people have been killed and 1 million people have been displaced. 11 Israeli soldiers have died. In Gulf Arab states and the occupied West Bank, more than 24 people have died, while 23 have been reported dead in Israel, and 13 U.S. service members have been killed. Trump says Lebanon not part of ceasefire deal with Iran. Lebanon is not part of the ceasefire agreement with the U.S. That the U.S. has with Iran because of Hezbollah, but will get taken care of, President Donald Trump told PBS News in an interview on Wednesday, a day after his ceasefire agreement with Iran. Asked if he was okay with Israel's continued strikes, Trump said that's a separate skirmish. PBS NewsHour program's Liz Landers said in a post on X following the interview. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt earlier said that Lebanon was not part of the deal, Axios reported. Dow soars 1,200 points on U.S.-Iran ceasefire. Wall Street's main indexes climbed to near one-month highs Wednesday after the U.S. and Iran agreed to a two-week ceasefire, sending crude prices lower on expectations that energy supplies through the Strait of Hormuz could resume. The announcement came hours before U.S. President Donald Trump's deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, the waterway that carries about one-fifth of global oil trade. A senior Iranian official told Reuters that the passage could be opened on Thursday or Friday ahead of peace talks if the countries agreed upon a framework for the ceasefire. Global markets, which had been reeling under conflicting signals for weeks, staged a rally with stocks in Asia and Europe rising while crude prices slid below $100 a barrel. Whether these early risk-on moves are sustainable or not is another matter. If shipping starts to move through the Strait of Hormuz again, and there's strong evidence that things can return to pre-war normality, that will embolden investors, said David Morrison, senior market analyst at Trade Nation. But given the complexity of the issues around this, a two-week ceasefire is unlikely to be sufficient to convince investors that it's safe to go back in the water. At 12:02 p.m. Eastern Time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 1,251.01 points, or 2.29%, to 47,835.41. The S&P 500 gained 161.61 points, or 2.44, to 6,778.46, and the NASDAQ composite gained 642.48 points, or 2.92%, to 22,663.29. The small-cap Russell 2000 index jumped 3% to a more than one-month high, while the CBOE volatility index slumped 4.74 points to 20.99 after hitting its lowest point since February 27th. The S&P 500 energy sector was the only one in the red, down almost 5%. ExxonMobil shed 6.3%, Chevron dropped 5.5%, and Occidental Petroleum lost 7.7%. Travel stocks soar. Travel Link stocks jumped, with Southwest Airlines and United Airlines advancing 10.8% and 12.8% respectively. They boosted industrial stocks on the S&P 500 by 3.8%. The top gainers, cruise operators Carnival and Norwegian Cruise Lines, added 14.2% and 12% respectively. The S&P 500 tech index rose 2.8%, helped by chip-linked stocks. The Philadelphia SE Semiconductor Index briefly hit a record high, last up 5.3%. Dow was lifted by gains in Goldman Sachs and American Express. This week, domestic inflation readings will be scrutinized for signs of whether the elevated crude prices during the war have added to price pressures. Comments from Federal Reserve officials and minutes from its March meeting will also be parsed. Market Bets shows a 33.9% chance of a 25 basis point cut in December, according to CME's FedWatch tool, up from 13.6% a day ago. Traders expected two cuts before the war broke out. Among other movers, Levi Strauss gained 12.8% after the denim apparel maker raised its annual sales and profit forecast. Delta Airlines advanced 8.6% in line with peers, despite forecasting lower than expected profit for the second quarter. It also did not update its annual outlook due to uncertainty over fuel prices linked to the Iran war. Advancing issues outnumbered decliners by 6.74-1 ratio on the New York Stock Exchange and by 5.53-1 ratio on the NASDAQ. The S&P 500 posted 18 new 52-week highs and no new lows, while the NASDAQ Composite recorded 108 new highs and 17 new lows. Trump weighs punitive steps against NATO allies over Iran, according to the Wall Street Journal. President Donald Trump is weighing punitive measures against certain NATO allies over what his administration sees as insufficient support for the U.S. campaign against Iran, deepening strains within the alliance as Washington presses to secure global oil flows through the Strait of Hormuz, the Wall Street Journal reported. The Journal reported that Trump administration officials are discussing proposals to shift U.S. troop deployments away from countries viewed as unhelpful and toward those seen as more supportive, including Poland, Romania, Lithuania, and Greece. Officials told the Journal the discussions remain preliminary but reflect mounting frustrations inside the White House with major NATO members such as Germany, France, Italy, and Spain, which have offered limited military assistance or declined to participate in combative operations. The Journal reported that some of those countries have restricted U.S. access to bases or airspace for offensive missions, underscoring the extent of Allied reluctance to becoming directly involved in the conflict with Iran. Trump's frustrations come as he was scheduled to meet NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte at the White House on Wednesday, with the Iran conflict and efforts to reopen the Strait of Hormuz expected to dominate the talks, according to Reuters and other outlets. The dispute comes as the United States seeks broader international backing to counter Iran's ability to disrupt shipping through the Strait of Hormuz, a vital maritime choke point that carries about 20% of global oil flows. U.S. officials have argued that securing the waterway is essential to stabilizing global energy markets. But key European allies have resisted joining offensive operations, instead urging de-escalation and diplomatic engagement. European leaders have made clear they do not view the conflict as one that triggers NATO's collective defense obligations and have sought to avoid being drawn into a wider regional war, according to statements and reporting on Allied deliberations. German officials have signaled that the conflict is not one Berlin considers its war, reflecting a broader position among several NATO governments that have stopped short of endorsing U.S. strikes on Iranian targets. While some allies, including the United Kingdom and France, have supported maritime security efforts aimed at protecting commercial shipping, their involvement has largely been limited to defensive or patrol missions rather than direct participation in U.S.-led attacks. The lack of unified NATO backing has emerged as a central point of tension for Trump, who has repeatedly criticized the alliance and questioned the contribution of member states during the conflict, the Journal reported. Trump has also repeatedly questioned the value of NATO and, during his presidency, discussed the possibility of withdrawing the United States from the alliance, according to reporting by the New York Times, while more recently warning that U.S. may not defend allies that fail to meet defense spending targets. The divide has also complicated U.S. efforts to pressure Iran into reopening or fully securing the Strait of Hormuz, which Tehran has used as leverage during the conflict by threatening or disrupting tanker traffic. Energy analysts and officials have warned that prolonged instability in the waterway could have significant global economic consequences, increasing pressure on Washington to find a resolution while balancing military and diplomatic options. The Journal reported that Trump's consideration of punitive steps against NATO partners adds to existing strains within the alliance, including long-standing disputes over defense spending and burden sharing. Pump prices to stay high despite ceasefire deal, market observers say. U.S. consumers will continue to pay high prices to fill up their vehicles or purchase airplane tickets through the peak summer travel season. Several market experts said on Wednesday, even as wholesale fuel prices cooled after President Donald Trump announced a 2-week ceasefire in the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. High fuel prices resulting from Iran's blockade of the Strait of Hormuz have become a major issue for Trump and his Republican Party as they campaign to maintain control of the U.S. Congress in November's midterm elections. The war has sent gasoline and diesel prices to their highest levels in years, and the economic pain has pushed approval ratings of Trump to the lowest since his return to the White House. After Trump announced a 2-week ceasefire deal on Tuesday, U.S. crude oil futures fell nearly $20, and U.S. gasoline and diesel futures also fell sharply as traders bet on a potential reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. But falling crude futures probably will not bring quick relief for consumers at the pumps, experts said, noting that cracks had already begun to appear in the fragile truce. The Strait of Hormuz remained shut on Wednesday after Israel launched its biggest attacks yet on Lebanon. Iran also hit a pipeline that Saudi Arabia has been relying on to bypass the Hormuz. There's so much uncertainty still around what this ceasefire means and when and how fuel starts to flow through the Strait of Hormuz again. Retailers are not going to drop prices sharply in the face of these unknowns, said Sean Hyatt, director of SAGE Business of Energy Initiative at the USC Marshall School of Business. In any case, retail fuel prices rise a lot faster than they drop, as fuel sellers will work through higher-priced inventory and seek a higher degree of certainty of future supply to avoid losses, Hyatt said. Prices go up like a rocket and they fall like a feather. U.S. retail gasoline eased a penny to $4.16 a gallon as of midday Wednesday, from a 4-year high of $4.17 a gallon on Tuesday, data from GasBuddy showed. If everything were to freeze right now, the national average could fall 5 or 10 cents a gallon for gasoline by this time next week, GasBuddy analyst Patrick DeHaan said. As of Tuesday, the price of the pumps for gasoline remained nearly a dollar higher than last year's average, GasBuddy data showed. Risk premium, regardless of whether the ceasefire holds, insurance costs will be higher than they were before the war, and ships will be hesitant to cross the waterway, said Alex Hodes, director of energy market strategy at StoneX. Markets still will be elevated throughout the rest of the year with an elevated geopolitical risk premium, Hodes said. Hodes and Hyatt said diesel and jet fuel markets in particular will remain on edge, as supply of those fuels has been tighter than other refined products. The Middle East is a key supplier of those fuels and also of the crude oil grades that have the highest yield of those products in refining. U.S. average retail diesel prices continued to climb on Wednesday, despite the ceasefire deal. hitting a $5.67 a gallon, the highest since July 2022, and nearly 60% more than last year. U.S. gasoline futures were down about 9% in intraday trading, with diesel futures down over 14%. Both remained about a dollar higher than pre-war levels. Gasoline futures were trading at $3.01 a gallon, and diesel futures were at $3.83 a gallon. That remaining risk premium is a reminder that the vast majority of vessels still aren't transiting the Strait of Hormuz, as the ceasefire plans still need to trickle down to the folks launching the attacks, U.S. fuel distributor T.A. Synergy's trading desk wrote. Levitt rejects Iran claim it closed Strait of Hormuz. By Michael Katz. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt on Wednesday dismissed Iranian state media reports that Tehran had closed the Strait of Hormuz, saying the Trump administration has been told traffic through the key global oil choke point has increased. The FARS news agency, an Iranian state outlet tied to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, reported earlier Wednesday that traffic through the Strait of Hormuz came to a complete stop because Israel violated the terms of a two-week ceasefire announced Tuesday, with attacks against Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah in Lebanon. Well, with respect to the first reporting out of Iranian state media, the president was made aware of those reports before I came to the podium, Levitt said in remarks aired live on Newsmax and the free Newsmax 2 streaming platform. That is completely unacceptable, and again, this is a case of what they're saying publicly is different. Privately, we have seen an uptick of traffic in the Strait today, and I will reiterate the president's expectation and demand that the Strait of Hormuz is reopened immediately, quickly, and safely. That is his expectation, and it has been relayed to him privately that this is what's taking place, and these reports publicly are false. President Donald Trump announced Tuesday night on Truth Social that the parties had agreed to a two-week ceasefire in the conflict that began February 28 with U.S.-Israeli airstrikes on Iran's political leadership and military infrastructure. He said the U.S. received a 10-point proposal from Iran that we believe is a workable basis on which to negotiate. The ceasefire came hours before a deadline after Trump vowed Tuesday morning on Truth Social that a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again if Iran did not agree to the terms. Trump wrote Tuesday night, based on conversations with Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif and Field Marshal Asim Munir of Pakistan, and wherein they requested that I hold off the destructive force being sent tonight to Iran and subject to the Islamic Republic of Iran agreeing to the complete, immediate, and safe opening of the Strait of Hormuz, I agree to suspend the bombing and attack of Iran for a period of 2 weeks. Levitt said Trump's tough rhetoric and tough negotiating style are what led to the ceasefire agreement. Iran publicly acknowledging last night that they have agreed and that they wanted this ceasefire with the United States because they no longer could tolerate being bombed by our very powerful and lethal military, and that they have committed to the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, which the president will hold them accountable for, she said. And it's something the administration is closely monitoring in real time. The world should take Trump's word very seriously in understanding that the president is always most interested in results, and it was the Iranians who backed down, not President Trump. He said that they would face very grave consequences, as you just laid out, by the 8 p.m. deadline, if they did not agree to reopening the Strait of Hormuz. And what did they do last night? They agreed to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Trump celebrates Fuller win, slams green on Truth Social, by Nicole Weatherholtz. President Donald Trump weighed in on the outcome of a closely watched special election in Georgia's 14th congressional district, praising Republican Clay Fuller's victory while attacking former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene amid a well-publicized rift between the two. Fuller, a former district attorney and Air National Guard lieutenant colonel, defeated Democrat Sean Harris by a roughly 56-44% margin in a race that drew millions of dollars in outside spending and national attention. Green's resignation on January 5th set the stage for a competitive special election in the strongly Republican district. Trump celebrated the race's outcome in a true social post that underscored both his support for Fuller and his criticism of Green. Marjorie Trader Brown's, Green's turns to Brown under stress, seat in Congress has been taken over by a wonderful and talented man, Clay Fuller, who won convincingly and right from the beginning, despite many people running for that Trump 37 seat and despite the stench left by Green, Trump wrote. Congratulations to Clay Fuller, a very large improvement over his deranged predecessor, he added. The pointed criticism marks a notable shift from Green's earlier standing as one of Trump's most loyal allies in Congress. For years, she was a vocal supporter of the president and a key figure among his backers on Capitol Hill. However, Green and Trump's formerly close relationship soured amid their disagreements on key issues, including the public release of government files related to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, an issue on which the congresswoman publicly broke with Trump. Trump responded by attacking Green on social media, withdrawing his endorsement and encouraging a primary challenge against her. The rift widened as Green increasingly criticized Trump's policy positions, including aspects of his foreign policy, and whether he was remaining true to his America First agenda. The escalating feud ultimately led Green to resign from Congress rather than face a contentious primary battle. Fuller's victory came despite an aggressive push by Democrats to flip the seat. National and state Democratic groups invested heavily in Harris's campaign, but the final result remained in line with the district's strong Republican lean. Turnout patterns showed stronger relative participation in Democratic-leaning areas compared to GOP strongholds, though not enough to overcome the district's conservative advantage. Some conservative analysts argue that the level of Democratic spending ultimately had little impact on the outcome. The Democrats spent millions of dollars to try to beat Clay Fuller, but ended up essentially getting the same number of votes even if they had spent nothing, Phil Kent, a Georgia-based conservative activist, told Newsmax. Fed minutes show growing openness to rate hikes at March meeting. A growing group of Federal Reserve policymakers felt last month that interest rate hikes might be needed to counter inflation that continued to exceed the central bank's 2% target, particularly given the inflationary impact of the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran, according to the minutes of their March 17th to 18th meeting. Some participants judged that there was a strong case for a two-sided description of the Federal Open Market Committee's future interest rate decisions in the post-meeting statement, reflecting the possibility that upwards adjustments to the target range for the federal funds rate could be appropriate if inflation were to remain at above target levels, the minute said. At the January meeting, a smaller group of several officials were willing to open the door to possible rate hikes, but by March and the outbreak of the war, many participants pointed to the risk of inflation remaining elevated for longer than expected amid a persistent increase in oil prices. The Fed in March held its benchmark overnight interest rate steady in the 3.5 to 3.75 range, while nodding to the fresh uncertainty of the war had introduced to the economic outlook. Despite the inflation risks, however, many participants still saw rate cuts as part of their baseline outlook, with most participants judging that an extended conflict in the Middle East would do enough damage to economic growth that even more cuts would be warranted. Most participants raised the concern that a protracted conflict in the Middle East could lead to a further softening in labor market conditions, which could warrant additional rate cuts, as substantially higher oil prices could reduce households' purchasing power, tighten financial conditions, and reduce growth abroad, the minutes said. The minutes were released on Wednesday, a day after the U.S. and Iran agreed to a 2-week ceasefire. The news caused oil prices to drop more than 15% to around $92 a barrel. The back and forth among policymakers at the meeting last month highlighted how the conflict in the Middle East, which disrupted global shipping and caused the price of oil to jump more than 50%, was pulling the Fed in conflicting directions, threatening both its inflation goal and full employment mandate. At the meeting, the Fed signaled it was unlikely to change its policy rate until it was clearer whether the impact on inflation or the job market seemed to be the greater risk. In new economic projections issued alongside its policy statement, officials penciled in higher inflation for the year, but little change in the unemployment rate. In presentations at the meeting, Fed staff saw risks that economic and job growth would be weaker and inflation higher than expected in their January outlook, given the potential economic effects of developments in the Middle East, government policy changes, and the adoption of AI. Given inflation above target since 2021, a salient risk was that inflation could prove to be more persistent than the staff anticipated. Epstein documents reveal extensive ties to Middle East elites, by Theodore Bunker. Newly released Justice Department documents show disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein cultivated ties with powerful figures across the Middle East, seeking access to sensitive political and economic information while offering advice on regional affairs, according to a review of the records. The documents are part of millions of pages disclosed under the Epstein Files Transparency Act, prompting renewed scrutiny of the disgraced financier's global network and influence. The records examined by the Miami Herald describe Epstein's relationship with individuals in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Yemen, and the United Arab Emirates, where he positioned himself as an informal advisor on geopolitics, legal disputes, and financial matters. Epstein, who died in federal custody in 2019 while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges, maintained a wide-ranging international network even after his 2008 conviction in Florida, allowing him to continue building connections among wealthy and politically connected figures. According to the Herald's review, Epstein enjoyed a remarkable level of access to sensitive information, like the outcomes of political meetings and the itineraries of Gulf royals, and hosted foreign elites at residences in New York, Palm Beach, and Paris. In a 2016 exchange with Saudi officials, Epstein criticized plans to publicly list shares of Saudi Aramco, writing that the proposal was silly, and warning that Wall Street viewed it as taking a cow to slaughter. He added, "Shareholders are the last thing the kingdom, Saudi Arabia, needs." Epstein also proposed a formal role for himself in the kingdom, stating, "I am happy to represent KSA, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, interests, while requesting to live in a small palace and serve as a financial confidant to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman." The documents show Epstein offering advice during the 2017 Gulf crisis, urging a member of Qatar's ruling family to take a more aggressive stance. "Qatar should stop kicking and arguing," Epstein wrote, adding, "Qatar needs to come out against terrorism, loud, FM. Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed Al Thani is not experienced, and it shows." Some of the communications include crude and explicit language. In a 2013 email, an Emirati businessman wrote, "She wanted some business, while I only wanted some pussiness," to which Epstein replied, "Praise Allah, there are still people like you." The documents also show Epstein involving himself in legal matters. In 2012, he advised Yemeni billionaire Shahir Abdulhaq on his son's case in Britain, suggesting a focus on what punishment would be acceptable. Abdulhaq responded, "I think you are right, something like house arrest plus charity work." Even during a 2009 jail sentence in Florida, Epstein remained engaged with international contacts, assisting an Emirati businessman seeking British government backing for a port project. After the effort advanced, Epstein wrote, "I'm proud of you." U.S. officials have not alleged that Epstein held any formal government position abroad, and some foreign sources cautioned that he may have exaggerated his influence. Epstein was responsible for serious crimes that caused significant harm to many victims, a Saudi source said. He was known to exaggerate and misrepresent his connections. The Justice Department has released more than 3 million pages of Epstein-related material, though questions remain about the completeness of the disclosures and the extent of his international dealings. Mace demands Bondi testify on Epstein probe, threatens contempt, by James Morley III. Representative Nancy Mace, Republican from South Carolina, has escalated pressure on former Attorney General Pam Bondi, demanding that she comply with a congressional subpoena tied to the federal government's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein investigation. In a series of social media posts, Mace emphasized that the House Oversight Committee's subpoena targets Bondi, not the office she once held, and warned that failure to appear could result in contempt proceedings. "We expect Pam Bondi's deposition to be rescheduled in a timely fashion," Mace wrote, adding that the committee must issue a subpoena to Pam Bondi, not the occupant of the office of Attorney General. She further warned that if Bondi continues to refuse to comply, she should be held in contempt. Mace also underscored that leaving office does not shield Bondi from scrutiny. Pam Bondi cannot escape accountability simply because she no longer holds the office of Attorney General, she said, arguing that the American people deserve answers. The subpoena stems from a committee motion approved by Oversight Republicans seeking Bondi's testimony on the Justice Department's handling of Epstein and compliance with the Epstein Files Transparency Act. Mace highlighted that the motion explicitly names Pamela Jo Bondi, reinforcing that the inquiry is directed at her personally. Mace's push reflects a broader strain of frustration among some Republicans who argue that past federal and state officials, including Bondi, during her tenure as Florida Attorney General, failed to pursue meaningful accountability for Epstein and his network. Critics within the GOP have long pointed to Epstein's controversial 2008 plea deal in Florida, which allowed him to avoid federal prosecution and serve minimal jail time, as emblematic of systemic failures. While Bondi has denied wrongdoing and was not directly responsible for the plea agreement, some Republicans contend that subsequent opportunities to revisit or expand investigations into Epstein's associates were not aggressively pursued. This frustration has intensified in recent years as lawmakers from both parties have called for greater transparency around Epstein's connections and the government's handling of related evidence. The Epstein Files Transparency Act, referenced in Mace's motion, is part of that effort to compel disclosure. Rex Huerman pleads guilty in Gilgo Beach killings. A Long Island architect who led a secret life as a serial killer pleaded guilty on Wednesday to murdering 7 women and admitted he killed an 8th in a string of long unsolved crimes known as the Gilgo Beach killings. Rex Howerman, 62, entered the pleas in a courtroom packed with reporters, police, and victims' relatives, some of whom wept as he detailed his crimes. He will be sentenced in June to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Howerman's guilty pleas to 3 counts of first-degree murder and 4 of intentional murder bring finality to a case that bedeviled investigators, tormented victims, relatives, and tantalized a true crime-obsessed public for years. Although he wasn't charged in her death, he also admitted that he killed Karen Vergata in 1996. Under questioning by Suffolk County District Attorney Ray Tierney, Howerman admitted that he strangled all 8 victims and dismembered some of them, that he used burner phones to contact them, and that he wrapped their bodies in burlap before dumping them. Wearing a black suit coat and white button-down shirt, Howerman appeared matter-of-fact and unemotional as he answered questions from Tierney and the judge. He never looked back at the packed courtroom gallery, keeping his gaze straight ahead. The women, many of them sex workers, were killed over a 17-year span and buried in remote locations, including along an isolated beach highway across the bay from where he lived, authorities said. Tierney scheduled a news conference for later Wednesday. He will be joined by victims' family members and members of the Gilgo Beach Homicide Investigation Task Force, which cracked the case with the help of clues that included DNA lifted from a discarded pizza crust. Investigators and members of the public packed the hearing. Reporters and camera operators swarmed Howerman's ex-wife, Asa Ellerup, and their daughter as they entered and left the courthouse. "My thoughts and prayers are with the victims and their families," Ellerup said afterward. "Their loss is immeasurable, and the focus should be on them at this time and moment. I ask that you give some privacy to my family as they navigate through this very difficult time." Ellerup and her daughter Victoria had no knowledge of or involvement in the killings, said their lawyer, Robert Macedonia. Ellerup has said she found it very difficult to believe her husband was a serial killer because he never gave off warning signs during their time together. Asked about Howerman's admissions, his defense attorney, Michael Brown, told reporters, "There came a point in this defense where Rex said, 'I want to plead guilty,'" noting that one of Howerman's concerns was sparing the victims' families and his own family from the ordeal of the case going to trial. In a response to a question about whether Howerman was sorry, Brown responded, "I would hope so. I would expect at sentencing he would have something to say." As part of his guilty plea, Howerman agreed to cooperate fully with the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit. The case began in earnest in 2010 after police found numerous sets of human remains while searching for a missing woman, Shannon Gilbert, along Long Island's southern shore, setting off a search for a potential serial killer that attracted global interest and spawned a Hollywood movie. Although her relatives disputed the finding, authorities eventually determined that Gilbert drowned, and Brown said Wednesday that Howerman had nothing to do with Shannon Gilbert. Investigators used DNA analysis and other evidence to identify victims. In some cases, they were able to connect them to remains found elsewhere on Long Island years earlier. Remains of 6 victims, Melissa Bartholomew, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Amber Lynn Costello, Valerie Mack, Jessica Taylor, and Megan Waterman, were found in the scrub along Ocean Parkway near Gilgo Beach. The remains of another victim, Sandra Castilla, were found more than 60 miles away in the Hamptons. Police also identified the remains of Vergata, which were found on Fire Island more than 20 miles west in 1996 and near Gilgo Beach in 2011. But despite the attention, including a documentary series and the 2020 Netflix film Lost Girls, the investigation dragged on for more than a decade, punctuated by fleeting leads and dashed hopes. In 2022, 6 weeks after a new police commissioner formed the Gilgo Beach Task Force, detectives identified Huerman as a suspect by using a vehicle registration database to connect him to a pickup truck that a witness reported seeing when one of the victims disappeared in 2010. Huerman lived for decades in Massapequa Park, about a 25-minute drive across a causeway spanning South Oyster Bay to the sandy stretch where the women's remains were found. Some of the victims were believed to have disappeared from that community, and their cell phones were found to have pinged towers in the area, authorities said. After the truck discovery, a grand jury authorized more than 300 subpoenas and search warrants, allowing the task force to dig into Huerman's life. Detectives collected billing records for burner phones he allegedly used to arrange meetings with the victims, retested DNA found with the bodies, and scoured Huerman's internet search history, which showed that he had viewed violent torture pornography and exhibited an intense interest in the Gilgo Beach killings and the renewed investigation. Cell phone data showed Huerman was in contact with some victims just before they disappeared, investigators said. To obtain Huerman's DNA, a task force surveillance team tailed him in Manhattan, where he worked and watched as he threw the remnants of his lunch, a box of partially eaten pizza crusts, into a sidewalk garbage can. Investigators rushed in, grabbed the box, and sent it to the crime lab, which matched DNA from the crust to a male hair found on burlap used to restrain one of the victims. He was arrested in July 2023. After Huerman's arrest, detectives spent more than 12 days searching his yard and home, where they found a basement vault that contained 279 weapons. On his computer, investigators said, they found what they described as a blueprint for the killings, including a series of checklists with reminders to limit noise, clean the bodies, and destroy evidence. Disgraced attorney Avenatti moved to Halfway House by Jim Mishler. Disgraced attorney Michael Avenatti has been transferred from federal prison to a halfway house in Hollywood as he continues serving his sentence for criminal convictions. Avenatti is expected to remain at the residential site until September 2028 as part of the final phase of his sentence, according to Mediate. Once a high-profile figure known for representing adult film actor Stormy Daniels and criticizing President Donald Trump, Avenatti was later convicted in cases involving fraud, extortion, and theft from clients. He was sentenced in 2021 to 30 months in prison in connection with an extortion scheme targeting Nike that prosecutors said involved a $25 million demand. In a separate case, he received a 48-month sentence in 2022 for defrauding a client. Altogether, Avenatti was ordered to serve more than 11 years in prison and to pay nearly $6 million in restitution. As part of his placement in a halfway house, Avenatti will be required to comply with conditions, including participation in mental health programs and testing negative for controlled substances. Further court developments related to his convictions have continued during his incarceration. The Supreme Court declined in 2024 to hear Avenatti's appeal, challenging his conviction, tied to misappropriating funds intended for Daniels. The case involved allegations that he diverted nearly $300,000 in book proceeds without authorization. Avenatti had represented Daniels in litigation connected to allegations of a past relationship with Trump. Trump denied the relationship. Gary Woodland manages PTSD at the Masters. When Gary Woodland last played the Masters in 2024, he was months removed from surgery to remove a brain tumor. At that point, it may have appeared to outsiders that he'd finished his fight. Woodland, though, said he didn't know what the future held. Woodland, now 41, revealed in a Golf Channel sit-down last month that he was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder in the wake of the surgery. The tumor, which was not fully removed in surgery, was located near his amygdala, the part of the brain that controls fear and anxiety. Not 3 weeks after going public about his PTSD, Woodland won the Texas Children's Houston Open, his long-awaited first victory since claiming the 2019 U.S. Open. Even then, in the midst of the biggest on-course triumphs in years, Woodland was struggling mentally. "I had a big battle Friday on Houston," Woodland said Tuesday, ahead of his Masters return. "I got hyper-vigilant on the ninth hole, and I battled the last 10 holes, thinking people were trying to kill me. I have security with me. The tour's been amazing. But I talked to tour security that night, and I told them what I was going through, and every time I looked up on the weekend, my security team was behind me. Anytime I got startled on the weekend, I turned around. Last year, I didn't talk to tour security. I fought this on my own. It was awful. Turning around and knowing that I'm safe, having somebody there with me, it's the only reason why I won like 2 weeks ago." Woodland revealed that the PGA Tour communicated with Augusta National ahead of his arrival, and he since met with Augusta's security team. "I'll have just like on tour, I'll have security with me," Woodland said. "The main deal is they were showing me where security is. The whole deal for me is it's visual, right? If I can see somebody, then I can remind myself that I'm safe constantly." Woodland said he hoped his win in Houston has a bigger impact on somebody else's life and that his message to those coping with similar adversity is to reach out and talk to somebody. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe and thank you for listening.